are listening to Teacher Toolkit, supporting teachers, parents and students worldwide.
Across schools and within schools, disadvantaged pupils are less likely to have access to those teachers with a degree in the subject they're teaching or with several years of experience.
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting-edge school resources and research-informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance and research-based publications.
This week, listen to Ross McGill, founder of Teacher Toolkit, interview Dr. Sam Sims, author and quantitative education researcher. In today's podcast, we'll be discussing why Sam spends his days crunching numbers, the insight he gains from doing so, and some of the actions he believes should take place as a result.
Hello everyone, this is Ross at Teacher Toolkit, the most influential blog on education in the UK. Today I'm with Dr. Sam Sims. Hi Sam, could you introduce yourself to listeners, please? Tell us what you do.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sam Sims. I work at the Institute of Education, which is now part of UCL University, and I also have an affiliation with Education Data Lab, which is part of FFT Education.
So I've been following your work for quite a number of years now through social media. This is the first time we've met in real life. You are real. Could you give people an insight into your day? What's a typical working week look like for you?
A typical working week for me involves quite a lot of time with my laptop crunching data. Various different types of data, but often very large data sets. And the thing I sort of set out to do when I wake up every morning, I suppose, is try to progress some research projects which provide useful insights for policymakers and school leaders. I also work from home quite a lot, so I've just got a 5-month-old Labrador puppy called Heidi, so she's taking up quite a lot of my time.
Well, I know the feeling. I've just got a 5-month-old border collie. I got her after a couple of months. It's interesting. Yeah. Dare I say you have to work more efficiently?
Yeah, got to work more efficiently, but you've also got to work out how to manage the dog efficiently. Yeah.
All right. So we might explore that a bit later in terms of workload. So that's your day-to-day week. So give us a kind of one or two key projects you're working on right now.
Sure. So the project that I'm working on right now today is an evaluation of the new phased maths bursary. Okay. So probably many people might not know how that works, I guess. So if you trained as a maths teacher last academic year in this country, you would have been given a £25,000 tax-free incentive from the government. So really quite a generous incentive to train as a maths teacher. And I think we can probably all guess why that is, because we don't have enough maths teachers in this country. The phased maths bursary changes that a bit. So it reduces the bursary you get paid during your training year from £25,000 down to £20,000, £5,000 less.
Yeah.
But it kind of uses that saving really and pays teachers a retention incentive. So they get paid £5,000 after 3 years of continuous teaching. In state schools in England.
So essentially changing the carrot.
Yeah, or moving the carrot to a different time point, yeah.
Okay.
And I'm trying to work out whether that is going to increase or decrease the overall supply of maths teachers.
Right. And when's that likely to be published?
Well, it's a project for the Department for Education, so I have to say, I do not know.
Let's leave that on there. Okay, let's rewind back to your childhood. Tell us about your education background, your upbringing.
I went to a small one-form entry Church of England primary school in Southampton, just outside Southampton. And then I went to a comprehensive secondary mixed school, which was about a sort of 25-minute bus journey away, 20 minutes.
In Southampton?
That was actually closer to Romsey, which is a small town just outside Southampton. But it was always an Ofsted good school the whole time. Very strong on sports. It was a specialist sports college. And then, as is quite normal, I believe, in Hampshire, but not necessarily in the rest of the country, I went to a separate sixth form college, this time in Winchester. So now I'm spending about an hour and a half on the bus to get there every morning. Which was a really brilliant place where they pushed you to apply for really good universities, a lot of support with exams, stuff like that. And I think that was that was a really sort of enjoyable time.
Any particular teacher that stands out?
Ooh. I had a very good history teacher, A2 as it was then called, history teacher called Andrew, who really pushed us to think about what it is that historians do rather than just, you know, sequences of events and all that sort of thing. And a really strong economics department, which is why I went on to do a degree which is partly economics and why I'm able to do the sort of research that I do now.
Okay, and I guess that set the foundations for what you do.
Absolutely.
Today. So where and when and why did that moment happen?
Well, I left university not really knowing what I wanted to do, probably like a lot of 21-year-olds, I guess. Got a job in a think tank called the Institute for Government, doing kind of public policy research, but not particularly quantitative. And then I was inspired by people like Becky Allen, who later was my PhD supervisor, and Simon Burgess, who works at Bristol University, both economists who use the Economist Toolkit to look at issues of in education and try and answer questions which are, you know, of primary policy interest.
Okay, and so I know Becky, fascinated with her work. Is there something that you both worked on since you graduated? When did you get your PhD?
Beg your pardon, sorry?
Yeah, your doctorate. What year did you qualify?
So I finished my... I actually did the viva for the PhD, and was awarded the PhD in summer last year, summer 2018. But yeah, I've worked on a couple of projects with Becky. So for example, we have a project looking at whether disadvantaged pupils are more or less likely to get access to teachers who are qualified, who have a degree in the subject they teach, and teachers who are more experienced, who we know tend to be perhaps unsurprisingly more effective teachers. And we find that both across schools and within schools, disadvantaged pupils are less likely to have access to those teachers with a degree in the subject they're teaching, or with you know, several years of experience. So it's an example of the kind of project we work on.
Is that already published?
That's published, in the Oxford Review of Education.
Okay.
So,
yeah, so behind the big table. Right, okay. Well, we'll signpost where it is, but it sounds quite fascinating. This is probably a very broad question, but I'm going to narrow it down to just give me one, please. What's the one thing you'd like to see change in education in England? Any particular passion?
Well, one of the things I've done research on is grammar schools. We obviously have grammar schools in some areas of this country, but not in other areas. Mm-hmm. I think it's still the government's stated policy position to increase the number of grammar schools. They need to pass a law to actually create new grammar schools, but I think if, you know, by hook or by crook, they would like to increase the number, and I think I would like to see that policy abandoned on the grounds that the benefits to pupils of attending those schools are really quite small. However, the benefits there are tend to accrue to socially advantaged pupils from rich backgrounds, and at the same time, of course, you're creating segregation by having rich pupils, or on average richer pupils in some schools, and on average poorer pupils in other schools.
Okay, so quite a complicated thing to fix, and the dialogue certainly shifted in my opinion, but like you said, the legislation with grammar schools and the new funding doesn't look like that's going to happen anytime soon. I'm going to ask you a kind of several pronged question, I suppose, in terms of workload. Or what would be your number one piece of advice to politicians, you know, the likes of Nick Gibb, Damien Hines, from your experience or your work in education?
For tackling workload, sorry?
Tackling workload, policies, listen to the profession.
Okay. In general, my top advice to policymakers would be that we need to shift from the current kind of mishmash of professional development approaches that we have towards more evidence-based professional development approaches for teachers. And 10 years ago, 8 years ago, I couldn't really have sat here and said that, because I think we genuinely didn't really have a strong view of what constituted effective professional development. In the last, or now in 2019, for the first time, I think we can sort of confidently say what constitutes good professional development, and that is essentially instructional.
I read your paper, though, Effective Hallmarks.
Good to know that somebody reads these
papers. Yeah, no, I did read it. And if I can do it justice, I've got a blog coming out on Saturday where I've tried to kind of summarise it slightly for in terms of someone reading the blog, trying to read it very quickly. What's quite interesting is you kind of look at the previous meta-studies and the consensus view, which even myself would consider the popular way of, you know, choice, yeah. Not yeah. One person at the front, those kind of things. But as I read through the papers, increasingly, not frustrated, right, okay, but then when you got to the end in terms of the instructional coaching and it suddenly made sense, because I think the last 5 years of my work, particularly as a school leader and now on the road, it does make the greatest difference. And I think if I could add one extension, would be to give teachers a cup of tea and a slice of cake when they have that one-to-one coaching, because I do think that makes a big, not just a feed, but the one-to-one coaching does make a huge difference. I suppose the challenge is with school funding, it's not going to happen anytime soon. But it was a really interesting piece of paper, and I'll share that in the podcast link that we're going to share here. Tip for school leaders, what would it be?
Tip for school leaders would be to also move towards instructional coaching, right, what they do in their schools. And a colleague of mine, or a collaborator of mine, Emily Henderson, who's deputy head at Brookburn Primary School in Manchester, has developed a neat model for how you staff up and provide the cover necessary to do instructional coaching within a school. So, for example, it means there's no cash cost of running the coaching, because you don't have to buy in an external person to deliver the coaching sessions. Of course, you need to develop the skills in-house.
Yeah.
And she reckons you can do it without taking up too much SLT time and without causing too much disruption to staff.
Right.
So I think it is doable, even though people don't have plenty of cash sitting around in their bank accounts to buy in services.
In my experience, you can do it internally. It needs very little support externally. It's that I guess the cost factor is the time.
Yeah.
Okay, top tip for teachers, in your experience of working with colleagues, maybe under the umbrella of workload, or top tip?
Right. I'm not sure what my top tip for teachers would be, to be honest. I like to be a bit humble about this, because looking at the data, doing the type of research that I do, I think I can cut good evidence-based insights for policymakers and school leaders.
Mm-hmm.
Less so, actually, I think, for teachers. Another thing that makes me a bit humble about sort of giving out my advice for teachers is that some of the best sort of evidence we have on when teachers get good at their job, or what effective teachers look like, is that it's the experienced teachers that are good. Teaching is something that you learn through experience, trial and error.
Tell us more about the teacher gap research that you did with Becky in your new book.
So Becky Allen and I have written a book called The Teacher Gap, which is an attempt to look at, we define the teacher gap on three levels, essentially. So we say it's the gap between what we know about the importance of teachers, if you look at the research, it says they're really important, and the way that we actually treat teachers. So, for example, lots of government reforms that have been making teachers' lives hard. There's also the gap between the number of teachers we need in our classrooms and the number we currently have. And there's the gap between the sort of quality of teachers we want and the quality of teachers we currently have.
Yeah.
Of course, there are many, many, many good teachers, but we have a shortage of them. And so in one of the chapters of that book, as you point out, Ross, we talk about what are the sort of sources of teacher expertise that have been identified.
Yeah.
And one of the sort of best evidence sources of teacher expertise is experience on the job. Teaching is very much something that you learn from, practice.
I love the
trial
and error. In there somewhere, idiosyncratic database.
Right, okay.
So,
the idea being that as teachers kind of go through their career, teaching is this sort of ill-structured problem where no two problems that a teacher experience look exactly the same.
Yeah.
But of course, the more kind of cases and experience teachers have to draw on from their years in the classroom, the closer a fit they can find between the problem they're facing and the problem they previously experienced, and the better they can solve the problem.
Yeah.
I suppose one thing that I would kind of advise, or my top tip for teachers, if I was going to give one, is that we know that that learning curve that teachers go on can be accelerated by working with or collaborating with other good teachers.
Yeah.
And the studies that have been done by economists in the US suggest that about a fifth of the quality of a teacher can be explained by the quality of the teachers they previously worked with.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to use the economics jargon, this is called a spillover, the idea.
Spillover.
A spillover indeed, in the sense that you know, the skills of your colleagues kind of rub off or spill over onto you. And you can see this in the data. There are really nice studies from the US showing that if you deliver some professional development to a subset of teachers within a school, let's say, you know, early career English teachers get it and later career ones don't, you can actually see in the data the techniques that the teachers who have been trained have learned kind of rubbing off onto the teachers who haven't been trained. So you get this kind of social learning.
And spill over.
Yeah, and I suppose that to make it a bit more practical, the literature suggests that you know, if you're a teacher, you want to work with the best teachers that you can find.
Yeah.
So think hard about which kind of schools you're applying to. The more you interact with the teachers, the more you will learn from them.
Mm-hmm.
So think about you know, how you can collaborate in a concrete way with the best teachers in your department.
Mm-hmm.
And I think bearing those things in mind is hopefully some good sort of practical advice for teachers.
So my old head teacher called it that the ripple effect, you know, throw a stone in the water, which is the same kind of concept, I guess. If I was a teacher considering leaving the profession, is there any words of wisdom or...?
Yeah, well, please don't, because pupils need you, but at the same time I understand that many teachers have had their jobs made so hard by either management or kind of government policy that they feel like they can't go on. And I have tons of sympathy with that. Particularly for early career teachers, the evidence suggests that early career teachers choose their jobs without much information about the schools they're going into.
Right.
And the quality of working conditions varies hugely between schools, as any teacher who's worked in more than one school would know. So, you know, if you're an early career teacher, you've worked in one school, your working life is, you know, not enjoyable for whatever reason, too much workload, too much bureaucracy, try to shop around and try to ask other teachers what it's like to work in their school.
Yeah.
And also, you know, if you're a STEM teacher or a teacher in a subject that's in short supply, it's a seller's market, right? You can easily get a job in another school, and you can probably easily get a job in one of the many good schools
and
that
are around. Negotiate a better salary there, I say. Okay, so quick fire questions. What book are you reading at the moment?
a very technical book
by
David Spiegelhalter, who's the former, or I think actually the current president of the Royal Statistical Society.
Title?
It's called Statistics, Learning from Data.
Right.
It's actually extremely well written, though, and it uses a lot of kind of everyday examples to kind of illustrate ideas from statistics.
I'm assuming you're doing your dream job, but if you weren't doing this, what would you have done instead?
Strangely, I don't really know. I love my job. I love what I do. So I don't spend much time kind of staring out the window thinking about what I would do if I wasn't doing this.
Okay. Have you got a phobia?
I'm not very good with heights.
Not very good with heights.
Yeah, so I like skiing. I've been skiing twice.
Right.
But there are moments when I'm skiing when my sort of.
Back to your dog. What's your. So now you're working out new ways of efficiency. What's your top tip? Teachers with dogs.
Teachers with dogs. My top tip is, as soon as they're old enough to walk them for a long time, walk them long enough that they're completely exhausted.
Yeah.
I think you need to wait till they're at least 6 months old to do that.
Yeah.
And also know how to distract them. Sometimes just play with them for a toy for 10 seconds and then chuck it to the other side of the room and they'll kind of disappear.
I find lots of treats inside a Coke bottle. Oh, yeah. Little holes for the smells, keeps them busy for 10, 20 minutes.
Genius.
Who would you recommend I interview next and why?
Ooh, a very interesting question. I think I'd recommend you interview some of the guys from the Institute for Teaching, which has actually just been renamed to the Ambition Institute after its merger with Ambition School Leadership. They totally get the importance of instructional coaching and have it kind of built into the philosophy of what they do. And they also think really,
so really
Matt
hard.
Hood
and
Matt Hood, Marie Peps. Hamer, Peps McRae, Harry Fletcher Woods. They're all great.
I shall chase one of those guys up. Okay, where can listeners find out more about you? Website, social media?
Yeah, so my Twitter account is at Dr. Sam Sims, and you can find a link to my website there, which has links to my papers, reviews of my book.
And which book should everybody buy?
One of yours, Ross, of course.
No, hold on. So Teacher Gap and
yeah, so
any others?
The only book I've written is The Teacher Gap. That's
any plans for another one?
Bit. Well, the last one took a lot of Saturdays and Sundays, so I promised my wife I wouldn't write another one for a while.
Right, good. It's been lovely to meet you again.
You too,
thanks,
Ross.
For you listening, everyone. It's Ross here. You listen to Teacher Toolkit. You'll find out more on our website or follow on social media using the hashtag TTKitPodcast. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.